When you run a nonprofit and you're in it to help others and you're asked to do more and you say, sure, that'd be great, I'd like to, but how about you throwing a little monetary support my way? And then you hear, we'd like to, but... Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropian. Thanks for joining us today. Nonprofits provide so much to our economy. I'm going to give you an example now. In 2017 in New York, nonprofits provided 1.4 million jobs. But a lot of nonprofits fly under the radar in our region. But as I said, they provide so much and they've learned how to stretch a buck a million different ways. Now, with that in mind, I was talking with Kate Lombardo. She's from the Food Bank of Lower Fairfield County. She and I were chatting on the phone yesterday, and she said, Ron, this is the toughest environment for donations that I've encountered in two decades, in 20 years. Kate's going to be joining us a bit later in the program, and we hope you join in. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. And on Facebook, check us out. We're at Full Story WSHU. You can always leave a comment there. We're going to start our discussion today by bringing in Bob Ward. Bob is the New York State Deputy Controller of Budget and Policy Analysis, and he authored the state's nonprofit jobs report back in July. Hi, Bob. Welcome to The Full Story. How are you?
I'm good, Ron. Thank you for having me on your show.
It's our pleasure. And, Bob, did I get those numbers right? 1.4 million?
Absolutely. Statewide in New York, more than 1.4 million jobs, total wages of over $78 billion, that's with a B, in 2017. And as you were just saying, the nonprofit sector is a very important part of our economy.
Are those nonprofit jobs sectored in one specific area? Are they upstate? Are they New York City? Are they Long Island?
They are all over the state in every area of the state, and the same is true nationwide in other states as well. But Controller DiNapoli, being the New York State Controller, our report looks at the impact on New York in particular. And, of course, the Controller takes a keen interest in all aspects of the state's economy because it has so much to do with the quality of life that people are able to have as well as the dollars that flow into the state government. So what we see, as I said, it is every region. If we look at Long Island in particular, more than 150,000 jobs are in the nonprofit sector. Many of these are in hospitals and other healthcare institutions. Some are in educational services, the arts, legal services, really the whole gamut of the state's economy. And those 152,000 jobs on Long Island, average annual wage of more than $62,000. So many of these are good paying jobs. Some pay less. For instance, home care aides, many of those are at nonprofit organizations, lesser paying jobs. But overall, again, a very big impact on our economy.
Bob, can we step back for just a moment? What classifies as a nonprofit?
Well, what we are using here for this report is information from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, which works with the Internal Revenue Service to look at what are called 501c3 organizations. These are what the IRS refers to as charitable organizations. So it is the great bulk of the nonprofit sector. Without getting into the weeds too much, you know, this is, again, a wide range of organizations, whether it's hospitals, social welfare organizations, entities that take care of the disabled, educational organizations, again, a very wide range.
So, Bob, from what you're telling me, it sounds like nonprofits are growing and probably will for the foreseeable future. And that begs the question, why? I mean, are there fewer government programs? Are there more people suffering nowadays because of social and economic inequality?
Well, in terms of the growth, you're absolutely right. Over the last decade, nonprofits in New York added about 175,000 jobs. That was about 14%. From an economic perspective, it's important to keep in mind that nonprofit employment rose during the Great Recession, while the overall private sector was declining, and certainly the governmental sector declining as well. So, many of these jobs are supported by public funding. Certainly hospitals receive a great deal of their funding from the federal Medicare program and the federal state Medicaid program, as well as other public funds. Many social services organizations, of course, rely on a lot of public support. And over time, it's increasingly become true of some others as well. Here in New York, the state spends a certain amount of money to support the arts and other quality of life endeavors. But at the same time, these organizations also receive important support from their contributors, and for anyone who's on a nonprofit board or runs a nonprofit organization, it truly is a balancing act that is never easy.
Mm. So, Bob, let me delve into that a little bit more. Let me ask you about the fundraising for the nonprofits. There are only so many times that you can go to the well, especially if more people are lining up at that same well. So what are they supposed to do in the future, especially in light of the fact that we hear about the state government budgets getting tighter and tighter?
Well, that's a tough question, and I think your other guests, I'm sure, will have a lot to say about that as well. Our report doesn't particularly get into the issue of nonprofit fundraising, but we are certainly aware that, for example, a lot of nonprofit organizations had concerns about the federal tax changes that were enacted a couple of years ago as to whether those changes might reduce the incentive for people to make contributions to nonprofits. There were also some particular changes that relate to how nonprofit organizations provide certain benefits to their staff. Nonprofits, in many cases, again, whether it's home health care or the arts and some others, don't necessarily pay, very high wages. And so the compensation levels get to be important for attracting and keeping good staff. And if the federal tax picture makes that more difficult, that adds to the challenge of keeping the budget balanced and keeping good staff in hand. But I think, one thing that we clearly can say about nonprofits generally, they know how to deal with challenges. They tend to be flexible and innovative, and pretty good at coming up with solutions to many of these challenges.
As I said at the beginning of the program, they know how to stretch a buck, right?
Exactly.
You were just talking about this, and you read my mind, because do you have any thoughts about the impact of the Trump tax reform package? Are you seeing cutbacks from businesses or other people because of the package?
Well, I think it's too early to have any actual data on those impacts, but certainly Comptroller DiNapoli has expressed real concern about some of the other aspects of the federal tax changes. For example, the limit on federal deductions for state and local tax payments, the $10,000 cap that was put on those deductions on Long Island and the Hudson Valley of New York State, many of New York's neighboring states, Connecticut and others. There are many, many thousands of people who are affected by that limit. At the same time, those federal tax changes did include reducing the impact of the alternative minimum tax on a number of people in New York. So it's some good aspects, some difficult aspects. But again, the state and local tax deduction impact is something that Comptroller DiNapoli has specifically criticized and said is a real concern for New York State.
Bob, one last question, if I can, before I know you have to get going. In Connecticut, I know we're hearing more and more about public-private partnerships, and I was curious as to what you think, what kind of impact that would have for nonprofits.
Well, I think nonprofits have been, for many years, an increasingly important part of the whole public-private partnership concept. Many nonprofits are the vehicles that New York and other states work with to deliver care to the disabled, to a variety of needs, again, whether it's in the areas of education, culture, history, the arts. These are services that need to be provided to the public, often with governmental support, and in many cases, nonprofits are ideally capable of providing those vital services.
With the 30 seconds that I have left, with the data that you have, do you expect the number of jobs in the nonprofit sector to continue growing?
I think that's likely, in part because we know that the healthcare sector, for one, is likely to continue growing as our population ages, and because a lot of healthcare organizations are nonprofits, that will be one source of growth, and there may be others as well.
Bob Ward. Bob is the New York State Deputy Comptroller of Budget and Policy Analysis. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ron.
We'll speak with you soon. If you would like to comment on today's program, please email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. You can find us on Facebook. We're at Full Story WSHU. And remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the Full Story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We have three guests for you this segment. Martin Cantor is director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy, and he's a former Suffolk County Economic Development Commissioner. Professor Cantor, always good to have you on the air with us. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm just fine. Happy to be here.
Dr. Jeffrey Reynolds is with us. He is the president and CEO of FCA, formerly the Family and Children's Association. Dr. Reynolds, welcome.
Oh, hi, Jeff. I've read a lot about you.
And Paul Pachter is with us. He's the CEO of Long Island Cares. How are you, sir? Thanks for being with us.
I'm good, Ron. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. Professor Cantor, I'm going to start with you. How important are
me.
Professor Cantor, how important are nonprofits to the economy of New York State and specifically Long Island?
On Long Island in particular, not-for-profits are about 13.5% of the entire workforce. But, you know, when you talk about not-for-profits, everybody thinks the good work that they do, you know, charitable foundations provide funding. But really, not-for-profits, you know, include colleges, universities, our public education system, arts, recreation, and, of course, the healthcare, which is one of the major employers on Long Island. So it runs the gamut of the 1-, 2-, 3-, 4-person shop that provides social services as a non-governmental entity, which are funded either by government or private foundations. But we have to, when everybody thinks of not-for-profits, that's what normally comes to mind. But they're big business here in the region and the state because they are, as I said before, colleges, universities, our public education system, and, of course, healthcare.
Professor, you know the economic impact, I think from my perspective at least, is rarely mentioned in news coverage. Why is that?
When you think about the economy, the growth in the economy, most people think of private sector capitalism growth. Because remember, the healthcare system, or in particular educational systems, that's provided by taxes. Or private after tax revenues of parents, healthcare the same thing. It's the healthcare. It's provided by the health insurance companies, and sometimes by the individual people who need care. So when you they're not really primary economic generators. They're usually secondary economic generators, which are funded by the private primary economic generators, which are manufacturing, making things and putting them in boxes and sending them away, or the exports of our state or our region of goods and services produced here. Those are the primary economic generators. So when everybody talks about economic activity, that's what you really point to, because you can't have growth, real sustained economic growth by the service sector, which is basically what the not-for-profits are. You need true economic growth is making things or providing service, certain primary services, and shipping it out and have other people return money to our region, and then that gets invested in the not-for-profit sector. That's why it's so important to look at the primary economic generators, and that's why that gets focused on first.
Hmm. Dr. Reynolds, it's good to have you on the air with us for many reasons, but because you can also give us the long view. The FCA has been around for what, 134, 135 years?
Yeah, it's 135 years. In fact, we're celebrating our 135th anniversary almost as we speak. And so we currently employ about 350 Long Islanders on a full and part-time basis. And over time, we've grown from an orphanage that sprung up on Long Island in the late 1800s to be a full-service organization working in Nassau County. And I'll tell you, and we'll probably go into not-for-profit wages at some point in this conversation, but I'll tell you that, I think, along with the other folks that make up our not-for-profit sector at Long Island Cares and other organizations, I think we've got the most committed, most dynamic folks in the world who do this not only for a living, but as a mission, as a cause, as their life's work. And so we're very thankful and blessed to have so many great employees that are working day in and day out, not only helping the economy and keeping things chugging along, but also helping our neighbors who are in need, which in turn certainly stimulates and helps the quality of life in the economy here in this region.
Dr. Reynolds, you bring up something that Bob Ward was addressing earlier in the program. I don't know if you were able to hear all his comments, but we were talking a little bit about wages, and he mentioned the Great Recession back in 2008. And I can recall back then some of the people that I knew were laid off from their jobs. They couldn't get other jobs. And I kept hearing from them, I'm going to go work for a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. You know, very often, and, as we've just completed kind of marking another anniversary of 9/11, I think there are a lot of people at some point in time that do some soul searching and kind of sit there and say, so at the end of this all, what will I have to show for it? How will I be remembered? What will I have accomplished? And I think a lot of the folks that come to work in this sector do so out of, with that mindset, and in some cases they've experienced their own setbacks and managed to conquer those, or they reached out for help maybe as a kid and didn't get exactly what they were hoping for, and they want to make sure it's better for the next person. We always balance that conversation, though, with the mindset and that people working in the not-for-profit sector have to make livable wages. There's a real fine line these days between the folks who have, advanced social work degrees and are working in the space and those that are on public assistance. And, that's been troublesome. And one of the things that we've always talked about is, how is this work valued? Is there a reason that the salaries are much lower in the not-for-profit sector? And, we know, and in my organization it's the same, that almost 80% of those who work in the not-for-profit sector are female. There's a part of me that says, how does that figure into the equation in terms of wage parity and wage increases? But we've worked real hard to make sure that, yes, it's fulfilling, and yes, you're doing your life's work, but we also want to make sure that you have the means to live comfortably and survive here on Long Island, which, as we all know, the cost of living is much higher here than in most other areas across the United States.
Professor Cantor, I know you have to get running in 2 or 3 minutes from now, so Paul, I'm going to ask you to hold on for just one moment because Professor Cantor has to leave us. But Professor, do you see the sector growing more and more as our economy changes region-wide but also nationwide over the next few years?
Well, I would certainly, you know, you're asking me an economic question versus a human service question. From the human service perspective, you hope it grows because it provides services for a lot of people who need it, especially health care. Obviously, I see health care increasing because we, as you're, you know, the I think the deputy controller said, you know, we're getting a lot of the boomers are getting older, and they're going to require the health care that's in the not-for-profit sector. However, if the not-for-profit sector leads our regional economy or leads our state economy, then indeed I think the state and, and Long Island regional economy will be in for a rough road. Because, again, it's a service sector economy. It gets fed off the primary economic generators of any economy. And if we don't, if we stop exporting our goods and services and in return getting after-tax spendable income into the region, then the not-for-profits won't be able to be sustainable or supported. And as Jeffrey said, the you know, not-for-profit companies have some of the lowest wages in the region. In fact, some of the workers in the not-for-profit sector earn below the median income on Long Island. So if the not-for-profit sector with its lower median income wages increases, then the entire regional economy will contract. So on one hand, you hope it expands because they're an important sector in terms of human services in the region. But on a pure economic sense, if it does expand at the detriment to the primary economic generators like manufacturing, then it portends some rough economic times for the state, the region, and the country for that matter.
Martin Cantor, director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy and a former Suffolk County Economic Development Commissioner. Professor, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure to be with you. Call anytime.
Paul Pachter is still with us. Long Island Cares. Paul, there are a lot of hungry people in our region, aren't there? I know from past conversations, it's one of the underreported stories around here.
Well, what we're looking at right now on Long Island is about 259,000 of our neighbors who are struggling with food insecurity and hunger. And that represents about 9.1% of the total population in Nassau County. So, yes, it's an issue. We're fortunate that we have a network of close to 400 community-based programs, soup kitchens, pantries, organizations like Jeff Reynolds and my colleague Barbara Farron, who's joining us shortly. You know, all of us working together to make sure that people who are struggling in the region at least have their basic human needs met for food, shelter, and clothing.
And I just want to mention that County Executive Laura Curran has declared September Hunger Action Month in the county to make everyone aware of hunger and food insecurity.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. We certainly applaud her, and I applaud Governor Cuomo, who is also announced September as Hunger Action Month and will be shining orange lights on all of the state buildings shortly.
Paul, where do you get your donations from nowadays, and what's the situation like?
Well, we have to look at our donations in terms of food and funds. The food that the Regional Food Bank distributes to people in need on Long Island, most of it, and this may come as a surprise to some of your listeners, most of it, about 60% of it, is purchased. It's purchased with our state contract, our contract with both Nassau and Suffolk County. And then we administer the Emergency Food Assistance Program for the USDA. That represents about 20% of the food that comes in to the Regional Food Bank. And then finally, 60, 70 food drives going on every day to support the Harry Chapin Food Bank, in addition to 85 different retailers on Long Island that are donating to us food and personal care products and household supplies and pet food and other stuff. And as far as the donations funding, as I mentioned, we have some state contracts, but I'm very, very proud of the fact that 50% of our cash budget is raised every year from the generosity of Long Islanders, both in the corporate and the private sector.
Dr. Reynolds, speaking of fundraising, private donations, and so on, are you concerned for the future in these economic times and with talk of a recession?
I think we're always concerned. You know, it seems to be the perennial state of the sector sometimes, and that you know, when things are going well in the economy, we always worry that people get caught up in their individual lives and making money and lose sight of what's going on around them, or they think that because their quality of life is improving, it's improving for everyone across the board. So we are a little bit concerned about the recession. I think one of the areas, and it's, I think, a perennial frustration for a lot of us, is that we've got a donor base that's aging over time, and that, you know, we have a very small cadre of very large donors, all of whom are aging out or moving on to other things. And, you know, I often wonder where the next generation of donors comes from. And I think, you know, increasingly all of the organizations, you know, including Paul's and Barbara's, we're all sitting here saying, so how do we engage young people? How do we engage the next generation? How do we convey the importance of what we're doing? And how do we give them a donor experience that keeps them coming back again and again and again? And I don't know that anyone has cracked the code to be able to do that, but I think we've all become a little bit more innovative in our fundraising events. Nobody wants to go to the rubber chicken dinner anymore. I think we've become much clearer in how we talk about our outcomes and how those dollars are spent. And so we talk in terms of an investment, not necessarily a charitable contribution. And then I think the third key is really allowing folks that are struggling, as well as those who are on the ground providing the services, to tell those stories and let those stories really breathe. Because I think, you know, very often if you simply allow someone to tell their story and how their life was changed by, you know, a case manager visiting them at home or somebody bringing a basket of food, you know, those are the stories that I think convince people that supporting charities is a worthwhile endeavor.
Dr. Reynolds, you bring up an excellent point, because we've had a number of programs in the past where older residents in our region have said, look, I've had it with the taxes around here. It's difficult to get around. I'm moving. I'm going to go to Florida, Arizona, wherever, someplace a little bit warmer. And once they go there, maybe that affects your donations.
It does. It does in a very, very significant way. You know, we've seen that. We've seen folks that are doing okay here and just leave for greener pastures. And very often the folks that are left here are struggling to stay here. And so it's a challenge. But I will say, you know, each and every day we get donations from folks who say, you know, I'm on a fixed income, but I think it's important that I invest in my community. You know, one of the things that we know is that in communities where homelessness and hunger and health epidemics are impacting the community, that impacts all of us across the board. It's not whether or not you see it. It's not whether or not it's in your family. You know, we know that these things affect Long Island across the board. In fact, you probably know that there was a very large report issued that we were a part of last week on the economic impact of the opioid crisis, for example. And, you know, they are certainly, most people on Long Island have been touched in one way, shape, or form. But more importantly, the community as a whole has been impacted by this in a huge way. And so supporting causes that deal with addiction or with hunger or with homelessness or any other health concern, or support the aging, all of those things get paid back in spades when our community is healthier and safer. And that's something that we benefit from, but most importantly, the next generation benefits from.
Paul, we have a minute before we have to take our break. As the CEO of Long Island Cares, what keeps you up at night? What are you worried about?
Well, to be honest with you, very little keeps me up at night.
But lucky you.
Yep. I think my biggest concern right now is something that Jeff just said, and that's looking at the changing donor base. The donors, the baby boomers, older folk, you know, that have been giving to charities for years, it's in their DNA, it's something they think of all the time. I mean, we're seeing shifts there, but I think a bigger challenge right now, and I've written on this recently, is going to be the challenges of the non-for-profits to engage the millennials. Right now, from what I'm seeing from the research that we just completed, the millennials aren't even at our doorstep. It's not anything they could afford to think about, yet alone make a donation, whether it's, you know, $20 or $30. So I think if there's something that I think about more often than other things, it's really looking at the future, the next 10 years, to see, you know, where the money's going to come into. come from, especially since we're an organization that, you know, relies upon donations, private donations, for more than 50% of our budget.
Paul, I know you're staying with us through the break and for the next segment. I'm grateful for that. Dr. Reynolds, I know you have to get running, and I just want to say we appreciate your time, and I hope you come back with us in the very near future.
I would love to, and thanks for doing such an important program with such great guests.
It's our pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Reynolds. Dr. Jeffrey Reynolds, the president and the CEO of FCA. And as I said, Paul Pachter, the CEO of Long Island Cares, is going to stay with us. He's going to be part of a number of other guests who are coming up in the next segment. Once again, if you want to comment on today's program, you can always email us. Easy to find, easy to remember, tfs@wshu.org. If you're a Facebook fan, find us on Facebook. We're at Full Story WSHU. And the shows are, all of them, are available as podcasts. Download the Full Story on Google Play or in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. One last break. We'll be right back. It is the Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and we're going to bring in three more guests along with Paul Pachter to wrap up our discussion today. Barbara Farron is the CEO of Federation of Organizations. Barbara, welcome. Thanks for your time. How are you?
Hi, thanks. I'm here.
Kate Lombardo has been with us before. Kate and I were chatting on the phone yesterday, and Kate is the executive director of the Food Bank of Lower Fairfield County. Hi, Kate. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Jeff Taylor, Director of Development for the Habitat for Humanity Eastern Connecticut Chapter. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Hey, I'm well. Thanks for having me today.
It's our pleasure. Barbara, since this is the very first time on the air with us, tell us a little bit about the Federation of Organizations.
Federation of Organizations is a not-for-profit that was founded in 1972, actually, by family members of people with long-term mental illness and who were at that point treated in hospital settings. And they have been pioneers through the years in working on changing how mental illness is treated and in the movement of the treatment to the community base. So we have a variety of programs in the downstate New York area from New York City and Long Island. We have about 500 or 600 employees, something about 550, something of that kind. And we have, you know, different issues because our funding comes from different sources. It's a combination of different programs. It's not so entirely, you know, Paul is just saying that he's raising 50% of his funding through fundraising. That's not our issue. A larger not-for-profit has more issues in administrative compliance, in creating the infrastructure that's required and is costly, you know, everything from IT to specialists in quality management and all the rest of it that's required in order to maintain compliance with the various entities that are providing funding, often government funding.
So is fundraising okay for you, if I could use that word?
No, it's never okay. You know, it's kind of, as I said, when Paul was saying that he's raising 50% of his budget for actual operations, that's not the problem for the most part in a larger not-for-profit such as ours. There, we need the little extra money to fill in the gaps here and there that can't be covered by the contracts that we have.
I see.
So it's more of, you know, just strategically plugging in donated funds to maintain programs that are actually pulling in much more funding, but they need little bits here and there to keep them going.
Kate Lombardo. Kate, welcome back. You and I, as I was mentioning before, you and I chatted for a minute or two on the phone yesterday for a few minutes. And you told me, you said this is the toughest environment that you've experienced in the last 20 years, in the last two decades. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, it's just we see that there's a divide between the haves and the have-nots is growing greater. Usually, donations come from people who have little to give. You would be shocked at how many senior citizens come in and still feel it's their obligation to give and to help because that mentality is, you know, is disappearing as they age and move you know, and leave this earth. Our local regular donors who would donate, you know, $50 is now down to $25. We're seeing it kind of dwindle away. And in the city we're located in, which is Stamford, Connecticut, many of the corporations have left. So it becomes very difficult to get people, one, to embrace the truth that there is hunger in Fairfield County. It is a gold coast. There's a lot of money here. However, there are deep needs, and it's more difficult to be poor when everyone else around you is, wealthy. Mm. So we have to get that notion across, and that's always been very difficult. And then the notion that, yes, we do need to be able to feed these individuals. They are here. They're cleaning pools. They're out there. They're cleaning homes. And it's become more difficult and more competitive. I thought I saw competition when I was with Goldman Sachs. I have never seen competition like this. It's very competitive between nonprofits to raise money. And this is... It's just a different environment.
I said at the beginning of the program, because you and I have spoken about this before, it's like so many people are going to the same well, and sooner or later, it's tapped dry.
Yes, exactly. And you can't continue to go to the same well or expect the same well to be there forever. People move on, lives change. And you have to continue to grow and reach out and try to, seek out other sources of funding.
Jeff Taylor is with us from Habitat for Humanity. First, Jeff, thanks for being with us again. Tell us what Habitat for Humanity does and how's the situation in the eastern part of Connecticut?
Sure, I'm happy to speak about that. So Habitat for Humanity of Eastern Connecticut is a nonprofit affordable housing organization. And our end goal is to ensure that people everywhere in our part of Connecticut have a decent place to live. And our organization is big on being a hand up and not a handout. And we believe that building strength, stability, and self-reliance in partnership with families who need decent and affordable housing can help break the multi-generational poverty cycle. And our program is kind of a unique program because the people who end up buying our homes work alongside our volunteers and their friends and family to build the house and then buy the house from our organization by paying an affordable, no-profit mortgage that Habitat finances. And the average mortgage payment for our homeowners is actually just under $700. So we make sure that we keep it really affordable. Now, the reason that we sell the houses is because we just simply can't raise the amount of money that we would need to be able to give houses away. And in the eastern part of the state, what Kate was just saying resonated with me because we don't have the luxury that other parts of the state have in terms of having large corporate funders who can continually contribute. We've never had that in eastern Connecticut. It's still very much a post-industrial area. So it's a little bit more difficult for us to find big sources of funding. So we just have a very diverse income stream right now, and we too rely heavily on small grants under about $5,000 on average, and we also rely on individual contributions for the majority of our funding.
Barbara and Paul, I'm going to bring you back in one second. I just want to ask Jeff this one question because it has to do with what the Lamont administration, Governor Ned Lamont in Connecticut, he wants to cut down on spending and borrowing, reduce the credit card debt, if you will. Jeff, how is that going to impact you?
Well, we actually have been taking advantage for several years now of a program in that's offered through the Connecticut Housing and Finance Authority, which is a quasi state-run organization. And that program is called the Housing Tax Credit. And so what Connecticut does is set aside a certain amount of tax credits every year. I think that last year was $10 million. And corporations are able to make a contribution to nonprofits who have qualified to win and be awarded tax credits. And Connecticut and Habitat for Humanity of Eastern Connecticut was fortunate enough to reach to receive a $500,000 contribution from Eversource for the last few years that we've applied for these tax credits. So it's certainly concerning to hear that there's talk of possibly cutting down on the kind of incentives that help us receive these huge donations.
Paul Pachter, I'd like to bring you back in. Paul is the CEO of Long Island Cares. Paul, after listening to what Kate Lombardo had to say, what's your reaction?
Well, I think, excuse me, I think Kate is correct. We're both CEOs of regional food banks, and you have to be concerned about your current donors and what their capabilities are, and also where you're going to cultivate and identify new donors. You know, there are people within our society that are extremely generous and are giving tens of thousands of dollars of grants and donations to nonprofits. But, you know, at some point in time, things are going to shift. And as we've been speaking so far on the program, that shift is taking place now. Mm. And unfortunately, it's taking place in a very good economy, which, in my opinion, is not a good sign. In a good economy, when people start to pull back upon what they're able to donate to charities, that sends up a signal that I think we all need to be concerned about.
So, Barbara Farron, does he have a good point? Because it is a good economy and still there are cutbacks. Are you worried about the future?
Well, in our agency, as I've said, is a larger one, mm-hmm. and we provide a variety of programs basically in the areas of mental health and aging. And it does vary from housing to volunteer programs for senior citizens, also benefiting children. You know, there's just a variety of things that we're able to do. The big issue going forward for us in the area of behavioral health is the changes in the whole healthcare delivery system at the Medicaid-funded level, and of course that will carry over into regular insurance as well. But the thrust, as several of your other guests have mentioned, we are facing a very large aging population, which will be more and more heavy consumers of healthcare, and therefore, the healthcare system, especially at the Medicaid funding level, is looking at how they can save money and improve care for people. So this is entailing a complete rearrangement of the payment methodology. And so we really have a lot of changes going on, and we really have no clue actually as to how it all will come together. But we're on a very interesting ride, shall we say, right now.
I'm sure you're very curious. I don't know if that's the word, as to who the next president might be, and in terms of healthcare reform.
Well, yes. I mean, it's hugely important. There's already, I don't know, I was looking at some statistics recently that, you know, there's been a decline in health coverage in the United States for the first time since the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, in other words, the organization of health insurance has dramatically changed through the years. Back in the day, it was associated with regular employment, and part of your benefits was the health care. So there is still some goodly segment of the workforce, often employed by government entities and large corporations, that are still receiving those benefits. But, you know, we are all talking about the millennials and the gig economy. So there are, luckily, the millennials are still relatively young, so that they are not running into all the health issues that the baby boomers are. but we have a larger and larger population of people who do not have adequate health care coverage. At the same time, the cost of health care continues to exponentially increase. So there's a lot of issues as we go forward. And the more we kick people off, you know, the less the fewer people who have insurance, the cost of health care goes up even further, because rather than doing regular care, they end up in the emergency room and it's at the highest possible cost level. They often, if you know, need very extreme care, hospital stays, all of which are much more expensive. So we have a lot going on in healthcare right now.
We boomers continue to cause a whole bunch of problems just as we did years ago. We just about have to wrap it up. We have about 3 minutes left. I'd like to give each of you time for final thoughts. Kate Lombardo, I'd like you to start, please. Kate, once again, the executive director of the Food Bank of Lower Fairfield County.
I just feel that, you know, with the aging population and the need, that there are so many needs out there. And I see the $15 an hour raise as something that is not going to help the poor, because their Section 8 housing voucher will go down, and their food stamp allocation will go down. So fundamentally, they'll be in the same space that they were in, just earning more money. And with Ned Lamont, the draconian cuts are really hurting a lot of agencies, especially the mental health agencies, and it goes across the board. I mean, of course, it's going to go. If you can't make ends meet, then that plays a pivotal role into your mental health, and it's very important that people recognize that just a dollar, just $2, anything they can do to help would be appreciated.
Thank you, Kate. Jeff Taylor, Habitat for Humanity. Final thoughts, please, Jeff.
Sure. You know, right now there's a conversation that is going on and on in Connecticut about what a great place it is and how we need to make investments into our infrastructure and reshaping our economic landscape. And I agree with all that. But a piece that I often don't hear is about investing in nonprofits and making that a real priority. You know, nonprofits, as you heard over this last hour of programming, we're on the front lines of many of the biggest systemic issues facing our regions. Affordable housing, food insecurity, drug and alcohol use treatment, mental health services, civil rights issues. I mean, I could go on. I can't possibly name them all. But, you know, nonprofits need that investment, too, and we really deserve it.
Jeff, thank you. Paul Pachter, CEO of Long Island Cares. Final thoughts, please, sir.
Well, I think my final thought, hearing what my colleague at the food bank in Connecticut just said, is, you know, if I look at New York State, we're very fortunate to have a governor that understands the issues, that understands the nonprofits. He continues to pick up the slack in terms of funding, where Washington continues to let the nonprofit industry down. So I think moving forward, next year is an election year. I think all of us in the nonprofits need to be strong. We need to mobilize the people that work with us and the people who we provide services to. We have to keep our eyes focused on the economy. We have to look at social policy and see what's coming down. And regardless of your political party affiliation, the very fact that this is a nation today that is divided more than it's ever been in recent memory is something that we all need to be concerned about.
Barbara Farron, CEO of Federation of Organizations. Barbara, I have 30 seconds, please.
Well, it's hard to sum up the whole world in 30 seconds. I can just say I'm glad that we are emphasizing the importance of the not-for-profit sector to the public sphere, to the employment, and to the well-being of our communities. And I'm glad that we have had that opportunity to at least highlight a bit of our work and the importance of it.
Barbara Farron, the CEO of Federation of Organizations, Paul Pachter, CEO of Long Island Cares, Kate Lombardo, Executive Director of the Food Bank of Lower Fairfield County, and Jeff Taylor, Director of Development for the Habitat for Humanity Eastern Connecticut Chapter. Thank you all. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for our show today. Sabrina Garone is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producer is Fatou Sangari. Sabrina Garone, Roberta Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.